So Heavenly Father, I thank you and praise you for this day, your Sabbath, and I ask that in this teaching that only your words come forth and not my words, and that only yours will flourish and mine will die. And I pray that maybe we will learn some new things in this Torah portion. In Yeshua's name, amen. So this still is the Kingdom Come series. It's continuing as Yahweh is still laying on my heart that we need to understand what Israel is, who the King of Israel is, and what will be required of us as citizens of Israel. This is all in preparation for meeting our King. We must make that paradigm shift from religion to reality. Religion is unreal, man-made, and not of Yahweh. The King of Israel is real. The people are citizens in his land. And to that end, I continue focusing on the King, his people, and the land that he wants to give them to live in, which is called the Kingdom of Israel. The first Exodus generation experienced their Independence Day in this week's Torah portion, and immediately after set out on what was the greatest enterprise in history to create a kingdom with Yahweh, Yeshua Elohim, as their king. The end times generation will experience an even greater deliverance, but we must first learn from the mistakes of the first generation, and we're about to see what some of those mistakes will be. Now, I want to pay special attention to what we Israelites owe our king in return for him delivering us from Satan's Egypt / Babylon to the Kingdom of Israel. Existing together on this one planet are two kingdoms, Yahweh's, which always was from the beginning, and Satan's, which came along later and is superimposed over Yahweh's for a time and by Yahweh's choice. That time, though, is coming to an end, and we can no longer afford to misunderstand the nature of these two opposing kingdoms. The Exodus accounts and the coming tribulation are the ongoing conflict between Yahweh's eternal kingdom and Satan's time-limited one. Egypt and Babylon are Satan's, and these are where religion comes from, with their man-made rules and perversions of the kingdom of Yahweh. So we must understand that there are requirements for us to be citizens in good standing in his kingdom. These are not religious requirements. They are national requirements for all citizens of his realm. And here in Exodus 13 is where we begin to find out what our requirements are, the first of which is our duty to consecrate the firstborns of both animal and man to our king. Now I'm backing up to Exodus 1 because it's part of this week's teaching. We Israelites will always be required to give, set apart, sanctify to Kadosh, the firstborns to Yahweh forever. That is what he says we owe him in return for being delivered from Egypt. Exodus 13:1. Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Sanctify to me all the firstborn, whatever opens the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and of animal. It is mine." Yahweh gives the reason for setting apart the firstborns in Numbers 3:13, saying it is because he struck the firstborns of Egypt on our behalf and will now take all the firstborns for himself. Numbers 3:13, "For all the firstborn are mine. On the day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I made holy to me all the firstborn in Israel, both man and animal. They shall be mine. I am Yahweh." It is within the authority of a king to exact a duty, a gift, a tax, a tribute, a sacrifice, an offering, or any other kind of payment in exchange for his help. And it is reasonable for him to do this in our reciprocal relationship. Now, I know this goes against the grain of Christian doctrine, which teaches that our relationship with Yahweh is mostly one-directional, from him to us. And it is all free for simply confessing that Yeshua is our Messiah. So, people treat Yahweh sometimes like, you know, a magic genie or a sugar daddy that they can go to get their desires fulfilled without ever having a real intimate relationship with their king. So, I'm going to go to something I have said for many years, and it bears saying again, Yahweh's kingdom is the only one ever on the earth which requires each individual to have a personal and intimate relationship with the king. We have to be personally involved with him and invested in him in order to be a citizen of his kingdom. Personal involvement spans more than just someone we go to. He's more than somebody that we just ask for things to satisfy our desires. Personal involvement requires time, talking with him, you know, prayer, and being a friend, and at the same time, submitting to him as his servant. So Israel's relationship with our king is reciprocal. He forgives sin freely. That is the one-way street there. You know, it's all for us. But otherwise, there is this reciprocity that must exist between us and our king, and we're finding out about it here in Exodus 13, the consecration of the firstborns. That has three effects. First, it helps us remember the firstborns of Egypt that were lost. And two, the sacrifices of the firstborns, along with all the other sacrifices, become food for the priests. That's in Numbers 18, 11, and 14. And third, the firstborn human males, which are not sacrificed like the animal firstborns, serve as living sacrifices in Yahweh's tabernacle or temple. That's in Numbers 18, 15 and 16, which sets the firstborn redemption price as 5 shekels. We set the firstborns apart because they are Yahweh's. They are never ours. They only come through us. But now I want to talk about donkeys, because in Exodus 13:13 it says every firstborn donkey must be redeemed with a lamb. And if you don't redeem it, then you have to break its neck. And of course it says there that you shall redeem all the firstborn of man among your sons. So why does a donkey need to be redeemed with a lamb, but the ox does not? And don't we believe that only humans are redeemed by the lamb? Well, in the ancient Near East, donkeys are important household servants. They're even mentioned as needing a Sabbath rest along with the human members of the household in Exodus 23:12, where we Israelites and our oxen, who don't need to be redeemed, our donkeys and our servants and even the strangers among us are to rest on the Sabbath. Well, while the donkeys are household servants, they also represent the sins of Egypt and Babylon, according to Ezekiel 23:20 and Hosea 8:9, meaning, fornication and the worship of other gods, which the Israelites were involved with in Egypt. Donkeys represent wildness and being stiff-necked, something Yahweh repeatedly attributed to Israel. Stiff-neckedness is a reference to the stubborn donkey. The spiritual and symbolic meaning behind the redemption of a firstborn male donkey, then, is that Israelites will either be redeemed or they will die by having their stiff necks broken. That's a symbolic thing that's been with us from the very beginning, the redemption of the donkey. Now, I want to talk a minute about Yeshua riding a donkey. He rode the donkey into Jerusalem, which symbolized the arrival of a king who is in control of his people. You know, the donkey, his people, serves him, and we are in submission to him as our king. David rode a donkey. The kingdom was in submission. The 12 tribes were in submission to David. That's what that means. Now, the Israelites have been delivered from Satan's kingdom to Yahweh's at this point. They have walked out of Egypt and are now on an independent people. The Passover memorial will forever mark their Independence Day. Passover will annually renew the agreement our ancestors made with Yahweh to be delivered from the wickedness and oppression of Egypt forever. Exodus 12, verse 14, 17, and 24, and Leviticus 23, verses 14 and 21. But there is more to memorializing this event than we have traditionally been taught. Hang on, and I'll explain that. But I'm going to paraphrase Exodus 3 to 16 regarding the terms of the Passover memorial meal and the unleavened bread week that follows. We are to remember the day that Yahweh brought us out of Egypt by eating only unleavened bread for 7 days, and we cannot have any yeast in our homes for this entire week. We are to keep this memorial at exactly the same time from year to year, eat the Passover sacrifice in the beginning of Aviv or Nisan 15, which is the darkness, the dark part of the beginning of the 15th, and we are to have a holy convocation or a meeting on the 7th day of unleavened bread. I want to explain that Passover is not a day. It is the name of the sacrifice. Now, the Jews spoke about the Passover in their cultural jargon, and that confuses people. We read about that in the New Testament, and, you know, Passover and Passover week and Passover of the Jews and unleavened bread. Those are all changed in the cultural jargon. But they include, the Jews include all of 14 Nisan in what they erroneously call the beginning of Passover week. Now, there is no such biblical thing as Passover week. There is the sacrifice at the end of Nisan, after the Nisan 14, after the afternoon daily lamb goes on the altar. That happens around 3 o'clock, and so from the and that ritual takes 30 to 45 minutes. So somewhere around 45 minutes to an hour later, let's say around 4 o'clock, that's when all the people brought their lambs for Passover and they started to slaughter them then. Then what happened was those lambs were roasted, and it takes about 2 hours to roast a lamb over a fire. And so by the time they were eating at in it, pretty much in the dark, starting on Nisan 15, the same day that they were eating the first Passover, with their loins girded about, with their shoes on their feet, and their staffs in their hand. And then they waited until they had the sign to leave. That sacrifice, then, is followed by the 7 days of unleavened bread, which begins on Nisan 15. So in the doing of the Passover, we are to tell the story of the Passover, either while we are eating or after we finish, and we're just about to find out that we're supposed to do that throughout the year when our son asks us. Exodus 13, verses 14 through 16, it just says, when your son asks you. Well, he's not going to ask on just that night. He might ask you, you know, in May or August, you know, why do we do this? And you're supposed to talk with him about it. And here comes some things that we are often not taught. And it comes in this chapter, in chapter 13, verses 9 and 16. And that is that we are to make a sign on our hand and our forehead to memorialize Passover. And we would wear these every day of our lives. And we are to set apart the firstborns. That's also part of this, as part of this memorial activity throughout the year. Exodus 13, 11 to 13. So Passover is so important to Yahweh that it isn't just on Nisan 14 at the end of the day and then 15 through 21 that we remember it. He gives these other duties to us to help us remember Passover throughout the year in our daily lives. Now, I want to talk about the tofafa, the forehead binding, because this is something that confuses people. Tofafa is translated as frontlet, and it is an ornamental piece of cloth hanging over the upper part of an altar frontal, in other words, the front of an altar. And it is a decorative band or ornament worn on the forehead. Additionally, Merriam-Webster says it references the forehead of an animal. Now, this is interesting because we lay our hands on the head of the sacrificial sin animal, that sin sacrifice, before it is killed in substitution for us. So, binding our head is associated with keeping our mind in check so we don't have to kill another innocent animal on our behalf. But it also says that a tofafa is an ornamental cloth over the front of an altar. Well, Yahweh does not have such a cloth over our altar, but over his altar, rather, but this should remind us that our brain is his altar and all of our thoughts should be toward him so that we can be in his likeness. And that is why we need to take all thoughts captive and be in control of our thoughts. And we see this kind of head binding even today on Bedouin men in the Middle East. And I suspect, but cannot prove, that the tofafa band had a symbol centered in the forehead above the eyes. And what was that symbol? I don't know. But men of the desert bind their head coverings as a practicality. Yahweh simply may have added a symbol of some kind to be worn on that headband, which was not, I believe, a Jewish phylactery box. These items are meant to be visible reminders of the Passover sacrifice and unleavened bread week when Pharaoh chased down the Israelites in the wilderness. And so speaking of that, Exodus 13, 17 to 18 says that Yahweh did not lead the people by the way of the land of the Philistines, lest the people change their minds about leaving Egypt and turn back. Now I'm paraphrasing that. I believe that our end times people may be armed as they flee to the wilderness, but they likely won't engage in war, just as it was the first time. I believe there will be supernatural help from Yahweh, and he will lead his people in paths that don't bring them into combat, but which could trap their enemies like Pharaoh was trapped. And one such instance of supernatural help is given to us in Revelation 12, 13, and 14, when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, and he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child, and two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman that she might fly into the wilderness to her place so that she would be nourished for a time, times, and half a time from the face of the serpent. Yahweh's woman in Revelation will be given supernatural help from him, just like the first time, including that he will give her two wings of an eagle. Now, some say this could be the U.S. helping the people to flee because the eagle symbolizes the United States now. But the problem I see with that view is that the U.S. is part of the beast system, and the beast is not about to help Yahweh's people escape him. However, there is an eagle with two wings rising out of the lowered water level of the Dead Sea, which can now be walked across. The mountain range between Israel and Jordan make up the wing feathers there along the Dead Sea, and the feathers hang inside Jordan territory, where that's where they're going to be fleeing to. And I'll put the picture of this satellite image on the website. So it is more likely that people will flee from Israel and elsewhere across the land bridges that now protrude out of the Dead Sea. Or it could be by some other quote-unquote eagle means that we don't know about yet. Another supernatural assistance will happen for us in Revelation 12, 15, and 17 when the dragon spews water after the fleeing woman and the earth swallows it up. So as Yahweh protected his people from Pharaoh, so too will he protect us from the dragon as we are fleeing. Now Exodus 13, 17 to 18 says that God led the people through the wilderness of the Red Sea. Now, through the way of the wilderness would have been an unexpected route for them. The book of Jasher reports that some Ephraimites had already tried forging an escape route for the Israelites by going through Philistine territory. They were obliterated. Yahweh did not want to subject the people to war with the Philistines for that reason, because, you know, Yahweh is a good commander who was saving their war efforts for the people who counted. And who were those? The Ites in Exodus 13:15. The Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Hivites, and Jebusites. You see, the Philistines were not even Yahweh's main target. It was all those Ites. But before they ever engaged with any of the Ites, they would see war pretty quickly within the first 2 months with the descendants of Esau's grandson, Amalek, in Exodus 17:8-16. Yahweh drew Pharaoh after the Israelites to position his army for annihilation. Had the people gone toward the way of the Philistines, the watchtower guards at Pihahiroth and Migdol in Exodus 14:2 would not have seen them, and they would not have reported that the Israelites were lost. But this encouraged Pharaoh to run after the Israelites. In other words, Yahweh used his own people to set a trap for Pharaoh. Herein is a lesson. We must learn that Yahweh will not let harm come to us, but he may use us to trap his enemies. This kind of situation often happens in military operations, you know, where they use decoys. Their own people become decoys. And because the Israelites came out of Egypt armed, this was a military operation, but one of a different kind, since women, children, herds, and flocks were present, and those folks don't tend to be present in most military activities. But what Yahweh wants to put us in, when Yahweh wants to put us in this kind of situation for his purposes, we must act quickly but carefully, which requires a special skill, and I'll share more of that special skill in a minute. But first, let's look at the pillars of cloud and fire, Exodus 13:21 and 22, where we read about the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of cloud by night that did not depart from before the people. We'll go to 1 Thessalonians 4:17 so I can show you what they mean to us in the end of days. It reads, "Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, so shall we ever be with the Lord." The clouds in 1 Thessalonians 4:17 are the same clouds as in Exodus 13:21-22. How do I know? Well, Isaiah 4:5 prophesies that the Lord will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion and upon her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night, for all the glory shall be a defense. This is why I suspect that the woman who flees will have pillars of clouds surrounding her. 1 Thessalonians 4:17 has to do with the resurrection of the dead, which is in itself a gathering of Yahweh's people that comes at the end of the tribulation. So, and now let me address us meeting Yeshua in the air. Where are the people when they are dead? Well, they're in an oxygen-deprived grave. Where will they be when they arise and are walking around on the solid earth? In the air. And where will these resurrected people appear? All over the world, or in the place where they will meet with Yeshua? Well, in the place where they will meet with Yeshua. And where will Yeshua be? In the wilderness, where he will gather his people before moving them north of the Dead Sea, adjacent to ancient Jericho, to cross the Jordan River in the same way that his namesake Joshua did. Now, let's go back to our Red Sea moment. That first generation began to be hostile to Yahweh early on when they saw Pharaoh pursuing them. But they didn't complain to Yahweh, they complained to Moses. And when Pharaoh approached their rear flank, they said, "Aren't there any graves in Egypt that you have to take us out here to kill us? Why have you treated us this way? Isn't this the word that we said to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians, for it would be better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness'?" Well, where in the world do we read that they said that? Nowhere, but we read it here. But here's the point I want to make about how we need to remain calm while acting quickly. And realize that everyone makes mistakes. Moses made a mistake here. Exodus 14:13. Moses said to the people, "Don't be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of Yahweh, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see again. Yahweh will fight for you, and you shall be still." Yahweh said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Speak to the children of Israel that they go forward. Lift up your rod. Stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the children of Israel will go into the middle of the sea on dry ground." What Moses had told the people was, "Don't be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of Yahweh," and so forth. Well, that is what Moses was saying, but Yahweh had other instructions. "Why are you crying to me? Speak to the children of Israel that they go forward." Oops, Moses made a mistake. He became passive and instructed passivity when he needed to be active and instruct the people to move. The point is about our leaders is that we want leaders that don't make mistakes, but that is not possible. It is an unreasonable expectation. And this also illustrates for us that no leader of Israel is perfect and always gets it right, except for Yeshua. There are times when we don't need to pray before acting. We need to have developed the skill that I spoke of earlier, of hearing the Spirit on the fly and be able to act on it immediately. And that skill comes from having that personal and intimate relationship with the King that I spoke about earlier. So that first generation saw the water split and earth come forth. The end time Exodus generation will see the water disappear inside of the earth. Revelation 12, 15, and 16. Now in Exodus 14, 17, Yahweh says he's going to harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they're going to go in after the people in, you know, between the walls of the Red Sea. And he says, I'm going to get myself honor over Pharaoh and over all his armies, his chariots, and his horsemen. Yahweh will get the honor that is due him from Pharaoh and the Egyptians by fighting his enemy face to face. Yahweh drew Pharaoh forth to position him for battle. Honor is only obtained when everyone sees who is the victor, and Yahweh will be acknowledged by Satan and his Egyptian/Babylonian cohorts, as scripture says in Exodus 14:18, where he says, the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh when I have gotten myself honor over Pharaoh, over his chariots, and over his horsemen. So this trap, which looked all the world like death to the Israelites, was also about putting the Egyptians on trial, as they had done to the Israelites. Sometimes what looks like trouble to us is actually Yahweh coming to our rescue. This is a lesson we're going to have to learn if we're going to really flee properly. Pharaoh had put Israel on trial in Egypt and had deemed they were guilty of treason against him, so he punished them by drowning their male babies. And this is called trial by water. In this trial, if the person lived who was thrown into the water and they came out alive, the verdict was innocent. If the person drowned, the verdict was guilty. And for this, the Israelite male babies were thrown into the water to drown, and they did, which proved to the Egyptians that the Hebrews were indeed guilty of treason against Pharaoh. So Yahweh turned Pharaoh's injustice against him, thus proving to Pharaoh and the Egyptians that the Israelites were innocent of treason against Pharaoh. How? By sending the Israelites through a water trial at the Red Sea, where they came out innocent on the opposite shore. And by the way, this is the basis for baptism. This is why after you sin or after you become unclean in some other way, you go through the mikvah, you immerse yourself, and you come out innocent, you come out clean. But Pharaoh and the Egyptian male warriors, which, by the way, were stand-ins for the drowned Hebrew male babies, were proved guilty. Every one of them died as the waters broke and flowed over them, guilty as charged. So now after this great salvation, Exodus 14:31 says that the people feared Yahweh, believed in Yahweh, and serve and his servant Moses. And then in chapter 15, we read about the praise and worship that Miriam, Moses' sister, led the Israelites in. In Exodus 15:24. We read that the people murmured against Moses. So here, you know, they just came through a water trial. Now they're going to have another water trial because of the bitter water that they found when they were moving away from the Red Sea. So how quickly we forget all of Yahweh's benefits, right? Moses made the water sweet, and Yahweh promised, it was a test for them, but he promised if they would obey him, he would not put the diseases of the Egyptians on them. So this was a test and an object lesson. Trust Yahweh, and he will not only heal you, but you won't get the diseases in the first place. Then Yahweh moved them to Elim, 12 springs of fresh water and 70 palm trees. 12 tribes of Israel, and 70 nations. They stayed in Elim until the 15th day of the second month, when they moved from there and then started murmuring again the third time in Exodus 16, verses 2 and 3. Again, we wish we had died by Yahweh's hand in Egypt, and you know, we were sitting by the meat pots and eating our fill of bread, and here you've brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. We're going to see murmuring over and over and over with these people. We have it with us today. It's part of the thing that is destroying congregations. The lesson that we need to learn is to not murmur, but to ask Yahweh for what we need. These people wanted Moses to anticipate their needs and just handle them without any participation from them. In other words, they were acting like babies who needed Moses to just know when they were hungry, and as soon as they started to cry, you know, just cram a bottle in their mouth. In other words, they wanted Moses and Aaron to be servants to them, and by extension, Yahweh himself to be servants to them, rather than them being servants to Yahweh, making personal relationship with Yahweh, and getting their needs met by their personal friend and king, Yahweh, by asking for him to satisfy their needs. But Yahweh said nothing here. He just simply answered them with the manna in the morning and the meat in the evening, according to 16:12-13. This was not just a provision, but also a test. Which individuals would obey Yahweh and which would not? We read about that in Exodus 16:14-28, when the instructions for gathering the manna was given. Verse 29 is where we find out that the Sabbath was given to Israel. It says, Yahweh has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you on the sixth day the bread of 2 days. Everyone stay in his place and let no one go out of his place on the seventh day. Well, in Genesis, the Sabbath was for all mankind, but now the Sabbath belongs to Israel. And it is in this chapter that we are given the first instructions on consecrating the Sabbath. We are to bake and boil our provisions for Shabbat on the sixth day of the week in preparation for the 2 days, so we are not cooking on Shabbat. The Sabbath still is for all mankind, but Israel is here being given oversight of it to bring it to the nations and, more importantly, for it to be a sign. Exodus 31:12-13. And the Lord spoke to Moses, "Speak to the people of Israel and say, above all, you shall keep my Sabbaths, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generation, that you may know that I, Yahweh, sanctify you." He says here, above all, we are to keep his Sabbaths, and that word there is plural. It includes not only the weekly Sabbath, but his other Sabbaths, the feasts and so forth. These are so we will know who Yahweh is. It is not for him to know us. He already knows us, but he will judge us by it. Again, in chapter 17, in the wilderness of Sin, or Sinai, not to be confused with the wilderness of Zin, where they will also be later, another issue over water comes up, and again the Israelites say, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to kill us, our children, and our livestock with thirst?" This is the third time the Israelites have accused Moses of trying to kill them. Somewhere along the way, Moses has told them that it's not a problem with him that they have, it's a problem with Yahweh. And that really is what a complaint is. It's a problem with somebody that you don't want to go to work it out. They don't want to go to Yahweh, and so they're going to complain to Moses. But here we have the third provocation so far. Moses cries out to Yahweh in chapter 17, verse 4, and he says, "What shall I do with these people? They're about to stone me." Well, I can tell you, I understand that, people. I understand that feeling. But Yahweh just says, you know, walk before the people, take them with you, take your rod with which you struck the Nile, and go. And I will stand before you on the rock in Horeb, and you will strike the rock, and water will come out of it so the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because the children of Israel quarreled, and they tested Yahweh, saying, is Yahweh among us or not? Well, you know, if you're not having a regular relationship and a regular talk with Yahweh, and if you're not approaching him with respect, that's going to be your question, isn't it? Ungrateful people say these things. Rather than keep their eye on the prize of getting their own nation not subject to Egypt or anyone else, they instead focus only on their bellies. Hebrews 3:7 says, therefore, even as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you will hear his voice, don't harden your hearts as in the rebellion, like they did in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your father tested me by proving me and saw my deeds for 40 years. Therefore I was displeased with that generation and said, they always err in their heart, but they don't know my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they will not enter into my rest. Beware, brothers, lest perhaps there be in any one of you an evil heart of unbelief in falling away from the living God. But exhort one another day by day. You know, help us. Help each other. You know, watch what each other does. Be concerned and help and encourage, so long as it is called today, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Messiah if we hold fast the beginning of our confidence firm to the end, while it is said, today, if you will hear his voice, don't harden your hearts as in the rebellion. Every test in the wilderness was a lesson in which they were supposed to learn something. They have been tested with water and food now, and they have had the wrong attitude about how to get that from Yahweh. And in fact, they keep going to Moses, who doesn't have the ability to give that to them. But what is the real lesson for them? Matthew 6:25. Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? You see, Yeshua's teachings in the New Testament were always commentaries on the things his people were supposed to have learned already. They were supposed to have figured out certain things, but the only way to figure out those things is to have a personal and intimate relationship with the King, Yahweh. And they never got there. So part of Yeshua's task was to teach them what they had not learned, which they would have learned if they would have had the right kind of relationship with Yahweh, because the Spirit would have revealed the deeper meanings from the law of Moses. But they stuck only with the letter of the law and never progressed to the spirit of it. That's what the Beatitudes are. They're the spirit of the law. And people can read and study Yeshua's teaching on the mountain and never understand it, because they try to turn then those Beatitudes, his comments, into just another letter of the law set of commandments. Unless we develop our relationship with Yahweh, we won't understand his kingdom, nor will we enter into it. After the third complaint, Yahweh lets them have war, something to fight for, so that perhaps they will begin to have a vested interest in being Israelites from the kingdom of Israel. They fight and they win their battle against Amalek. And next week, we will get to the Mount Sinai experience, even if Yahweh has to drag them there kicking and screaming.